Welcome to episode 26 of How to Stay Sane in an Insane World, the podcast formerly known as Scheduled. Now, today we're broadcasting a slightly different kind of episode. And this is going to be from an expert perspective rather than hearing about somebody's experiences with their own illness. And I'm delighted to say that the expert on the show is renowned psychotherapist Paul Sunderman. Paul has over 30 years of experience in the field, covering all aspects of addiction and additional subjects as well. He has held the post of head of treatment at Clarence Health in the UK and clinical director of Crossroads Centre in Antigua. The subject Paul has agreed to speak about today is, drumroll, codependency. Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jeremy. Nice to be here.
Really?
Very interesting to be introduced. A 30 years of experience, it's probably nearly 40 years now. And there comes a point, doesn't it? You need to have about 10 years to sort of make it, you know, for someone to take you seriously, like maybe he knows his stuff. When you get close to 40, I think the question is, what are you doing here?
That's right. You're on.
Anyway.
How do we know? So look, before we start, can I ask, you know, a little bit about you and what led you to join the world of psychotherapy, etc.?
I was at, you know, age 23. I had been a lost boy who became a heroin addict. I did rehab. I was very fortunate that it was just the beginning of the rehab world in the UK. I also was fortunate to have some privilege in the sense of access to resources. And I did some rehab, having got myself into a whole lot of trouble. And having ceased to be a heroin addict for a number of years, I found myself doing some volunteer work at Reading Prison. Oh. Once a week. And Reading Prison was a prison where if you came in, if you were caught at Heathrow with some heroin up your bottom, that's where they put you on remand. And so there's a lot of people with drug problems there. And we did, on one evening, a couple of us would go down and do a little sort of self-help sort of teaching, psychoeducation experience about addiction and recovery. And I used to come back and from there, and I was... I didn't realize I was sort of happier doing that than I was doing, you know, my day job. And then I decided to essentially begin a training as an addictions counselor, and that's sort of in my mid-20s. And then later trained as a psychotherapist and did psychology training. And I trained at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital at the Department of Psychiatry to do my psychotherapy training.
Brilliant. Oh, well, I can get that. And this will sound like a picky question, but it's an interesting phrase you had, that you were a lost boy. What does that mean? I mean, I'm not just trying to be provocative, but I'm just interested that what you mean by that. It's very interesting.
No, well, thanks very much. And I like clarity. You know, mental health is about a commitment to reality, you know, and clarity. By lost boy, I mean, I think I had lost myself and I'd lost faith in human beings to help me to, in psychological terms, you say, regulate my mood, give me a sense of belonging and safety that would allow me to be in connection with myself and with others and with the world. So as a lost boy, I was operating from a place of survival and protection rather than belonging and connection. And at some point, there's Arthur Janov, who wrote the book Primal Scream, from which the band came.
Yeah.
You know, one of his questions back in the 70s used to be to some of his clients. He's a psychologist, psychotherapist, and a really good question. He used to say, you know, at what point in your life did you lose faith in human beings to feel safe and, you know, to manage your mood? And I think that's the lost that I refer to. I you know, developmentally, if experience is the architect of the brain, you know, my brain did not experience a sense of safety for a number of reasons. And, I lost the capacity to feel safe and to connect. And my heroin addiction was an adaptive response to that in the interest of survival.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Turned out to be not a good long-term plan.
So thank you for that. That's really good. A broad question. I mean, mental health has come to the fore a lot in the last, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, I guess, in this country, the discussion on it, and maybe since COVID, actually, probably. If I ask you, can you spot the differences between 40 years ago and the attitude compared to now? What might you say?
I guess we know an awful lot more, and we have a greater ability to work out what's going on. 40 years ago, there weren't MRI scans, for example. We couldn't have a look at the brain. We couldn't really see what lit up when. The development of the understanding of the brain has come a very long way from early psychiatry. So the brain is sort of cogs and pulleys and all that sort of thing. Now, we can map the brain. We know we have more than one brain. We know that unfortunately some parts of the brain can dominate other parts. We have more of an understanding about what goes on. I think we also have more of a tolerance for talking about distress. We've reached a long way in this country from a stiff upper lip, for example. And I think we were really confronted with probably things like the Vietnam War, with the fact that actually, people who have disturbing experiences can end up being disturbed, and disturbed people are disturbing. This has an impact on society. I think there's more of an understanding too, of course, that addiction can come out of these things. It's an attempt at self-regulation. So I think there's that. It's become, there's an awful lot of what they call quit lit, people telling their stories, in different ways. Yeah. And we all, we warm to somebody who's being authentic, as human. We feel safe. If you tell me who you are and how you feel, then I feel regulated in that experience. So I think that's happening. People feel a sense of...
Well, that's very much what we've tried to do with this podcast, to have authenticity, honesty, and not necessarily bleeding hearts, but, I think that authenticity is really important. Just for people who go, I'm lost, I don't know, I feel terrible, blah, blah, blah. I can listen, oh my God, that's their story. And they've done all these things. And, that's very much what we're about here. So I think that's well said. I mean, I personally think, you've really said it, that people are much more sympathetic and less embarrassed, less ashamed about talking about these subjects. My brother, blah, 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 whilst before, we don't talk about him. And I think that's, I think that's great. And I just hope that everyone keeps talking about solutions as well, how people can get better, stay better, and, that's me anyway.
It's so important, because if you can't talk about problems, you can't talk about solutions, and, as human beings, in many ways, we become distressed in relationships. So relationships, but we can also become well in relationships. So relationships are both a source of pain, but also a source of healing. And I think, as we know that, it's gathering momentum, isn't it? And we've expanded in psychology, you probably know, the Overton window, the idea of what it's okay to talk about and you can take most people with. Suddenly it's all right to talk about all sorts of things now that it wasn't okay to talk about. And of course, as you mentioned, COVID, there's an epidemic of teenage anorexia, that's come about around COVID. So there's a lot of questions to ask, and really problematic things going on.
Well, I think there was so much isolation as well in COVID. That seemed to me just to fertilize the whole, loads and loads of problems. And I mean, it's a lot to answer for, in that sense.
Well, mental health is relational health, of course. Emotional health is relational health. And if you are isolated from relationships, then actually that has a direct impact.
Yeah, well, I mean... I think lots of people were, particularly people who lived on their own in that setup. There was no pub to go to or shops. And I think it'd be very interesting to see, seriously, to see a documentary, a decent documentary, series done on that, on COVID and the effects of it. But I think it's quite big. Okay, before we get into the meat and potatoes, I just wanted to add one tiny query, which is, what was it like living and working in Antigua? What was it? Was it fantastic? Or didn't you notice the environment?
I certainly noticed a difference moving from working in a hospital-based addiction treatment in Wiltshire in the southwest of England to working in Antigua in the West Indies. It was one of those opportunities that I was headhunted for, and if I didn't say yes, I'd probably spend the rest of my life thinking, I probably should have. It was complicated for us because we have five children between, so the youngest, my second youngest was coming up for age two, and between being offered the job and going out there, my wife became pregnant with our fifth child. Oh. And so, you know, we ended up in Antigua, you know, pregnant, as, you know, older parents by, you know, by then. And then, of course, trying to set up, I mean, a fantastic setup. And I've always liked working for the charitable organizations, actually. And, you know, where I worked at Clyde's House was simply because the patient group is a social microcosm. There's nothing, nobody special or thinks they are and are different. But, you know, we brought together a treatment team from people from North America, but from Europe, and of course clients too, local clients. Crossroads Centre was set up to really help some of the local community, had big problems with both, you know, alcohol, but also the trafficking of cocaine through Antigua and possibly the laundering.
Right.
So we tried to bring flush people together in treatment. That wasn't completely straightforward. I did swim in the sea a bit, but most of the time I was tearing my hair out trying to, you know, set up a treatment program.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Get things going, but the sea was warm.
Well, it's just my superficial personality, you know. I like to know about that. Okay, right, let's get cracking. You know, there are certain terms that I come across, or have come across over the years, where people go, yes, ADHD, yes, I know all about that, and, you know, bipolar, I know exactly what bipolar is. And they don't know. And codependency, I think, is a banded about term. And we here today need to know what it is. What is, you know, what is codependency? Is it something that you catch? Is it something that develops in you? Is it a condition? There are all sorts of possibilities, I think. And I'd really like to, I know it's a big ask, but well, we can back and forth. In the main, what is it, codependency?
Okay. Well, codependency. The first thing to tell you is that psychiatric illnesses are listed. There are two main manuals internationally. One is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. The other is something that the World Health Organization signs up to, which is the International Classification of Diseases. And pretty much everything will be classified in there, along with diagnostic criteria, so clusters of symptoms. Now, the thing about mental health diagnosis, unlike a physical diagnosis, it doesn't rely on biomarkers. So there isn't a scan for mental health, a brain scan. We're not doing a blood test. We're not examining a rash. We're looking at clusters of symptoms that change over time, by the way. You know, you mentioned ADHD. Personally, I think it's massively overdiagnosed. Mm-hmm. The criteria has expanded. It's clusters of symptoms. It's based on observations and reports. And it overlaps with all sorts of other conditions as well. So everything is changing all the time. Now, ADHD, of course, will be in a classification of diseases, as is drug dependence, for example. Some of the other addictions that we call process addictions aren't classified. Right. Compulsive spending, so-called love addiction, workaholism, these sorts of things. Yeah, people feel they know what they mean. Codependency is not a classification. It has a history, and it probably means it has a sense to most people who use the word, but I should think everybody uses it differently. And it began historically, I'm sorry this is a long answer, but we'll get there. It began really, it came out of the addictions field, where the first of all, addiction was treating alcohol dependence, or what they called alcoholism in the 60s and 70s. And the partner of the alcoholic was called the co-alcoholic. People then understood that addiction or drug addiction wasn't about a specific drug. It was it was an addiction to changing the way that you felt with a mood-altering chemical. So people in the 70s were then being treated for chemical dependency, whether it was alcohol dependency or heroin dependency, and their partners were called the co dependence. And that's how it began. What then happened, there started to be a whole lot of literature, and people, Robin Norwood wrote a best-selling book, you probably know, in the 80s called Women Who Love Too Much. It was terribly popular. Yeah. She was a family counsellor. And what she was starting to see in terms of observation was that actually there were people that were as addicted to their addict as the addict was to their substance or their process. Namely, there were two addicts within a relationship.
But is that saying, sorry to interrupt you, is that saying that it could only, this only existed between two people, you know, whether one was an addict?
That time, and this is the thing, Jeremy, all of this has really, really changed. Right. So fast forward to where we are today, and essentially the understandings. But the point I want to make is this isn't something that's, you know, it's not diagnosed in any way other than report and observation, and it's a changing diagnosis. And many people think of codependency as either being either controlling behavior or being sort of people-pleasing behavior. And some people will be critical and say we just sort of pathologized being nice, but codependency has a price. It's a price. There's a price to nice. So currently, we think about codependency being the management of anxiety through how we behave in a relationship. So I either manage my anxiety by putting you at dis-ease, making you feel very uncomfortable, maybe be coercive and controlling, call you names, manage my anxiety using you to put you at dis-ease so I could feel better, or I manage my anxiety by putting you at ease. Jeremy, you're a frightfully bright and intelligent person. What a pleasure it is to be on your podcast. Thank you so much.
It's got it.
Managing anxiety by putting people either at ease or dis-ease. And we now understand there's a whole lot of stuff that comes that sets that up. And gosh, you know, nothing wrong with putting someone at ease. But, you know, at its extreme, putting people at ease becomes a bit like setting yourself on fire to keep someone else warm, or putting people at dis-ease becomes things like coercive controlling behavior.
Yeah, I see. Gosh, right. So just as a pause, I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with, you know, I am dependent on you, you know, and I cannot get out of that. I have to be with you all the time, and you can't leave me because my life or my, I don't know, say anxiety depends upon me. And I'm just saying, is this a possibility with codependent, or is that way off beam?
It's offbeat at all. Bear in mind, there is no proper definition of codependence, but you're absolutely right. It's about how we manage our anxiety in relationships. So the example you've given is, I can't live without you, Jeremy. Do you know, I'm dependent. My survival, if you like, is dependent on hanging on to your coattails, Jeremy, and following you around. And I get very anxious if that doesn't happen. So I'm going to do everything I can to survive in your proximity.
Yes, and sacrifice, sacrifice yourself for the other person.
A loss of self, a subordinating of needs, and a sort of an unconscious contract. If I'm putting you at ease, I'll be here for you. You know, I will meet your needs. And there's a bit of small print there in the contract, which is, I'm rather hoping that eventually you'll see I'm a good person and you'll meet my needs. But the print is too small. We call it taking hope here.
Yes. Got it. Okay. Gosh. Yeah. It's loose in some ways.
Loose and developing. And gosh, a bit like, think about post-traumatic stress disorder. It used to be called shell shock, do you know? It's moved on a long way now. The recent diagnosis for PTSD, it's not just what happened to you, it's what you saw happen. It's what you might have heard has happened to someone important to you. These diagnoses are changing all the time. They're hypotheses, they're clusters of symptoms to help us understand things. And do you know what? 10 years' time, it'll all be different.
Yeah, interesting. It isn't set in concrete. Yeah. And I think the one about the relationships and how somebody can subjugate themselves, you know, we sort of see that in life, don't we? Where, you know, somebody's you know, just a slave to somebody, or they just you know, let them walk all over them, or whatever, just so they can stay in the situation, and the situation is what, in their mind, is keeping them together, presumably.
Yes. It is an addiction, hence the word dependence, like any other addiction.
Yeah.
It's an adaptive response to something. So as you said earlier, you don't catch it. It doesn't happen by accident. It's not a virus and it's not a banana skin that you slip on. It's an adaptive response to a sense of not feeling safe in the world and in oneself. You know, this is all about now the science, and addiction is all about the science of safety. So it's almost like, unless I stay close to you, I won't survive. I won't be safe.
Yes. Because I was going to, say, you know, what are the causes of this? This is something that, you know, it is triggered by something that happened in childhood, some sort of abandonment. And then, God, now I've got back. I've got this person to be with me.
Well, it's a bit like addiction in general. There was a big movement to try and see it as something that was somehow sort of genetic. There isn't an addiction gene. Addiction runs in families, but, you know, we tend to think that people, or certainly can do, you know, they pick up ways of coping rather than actually inherit them genetically. So perhaps there are some elements, a predisposition perhaps, to some anxiety and things like that. But so codependency, like any other addiction, is maybe genetically proposed, perhaps, yeah, but it's environmentally disposed. And it comes out of an overwhelming, if you like, a sense of not being safe, a sense of danger, and a lack of human trust in human beings to regulate mood. So in psychology, we call it co-regulation. When co-regulation fails, you know, you and I talking, feeling safe, solving problems, creating, collaborating. When that fails, there is an emphasis on survival via what we call self-regulation.
Yeah.
And that self-regulation is what tends to become either a mental health issue or an addictive process where I can't trust anyone else. I shall be compulsively self-reliant in the hope that, you know, somehow I can survive. But it ends up being like drinking seawater to quench your thirst. You go bonkers. Because you can't get enough of what you don't need. That's the
there isn't a standard thing where you're going, look, you know, normally people who become codependent are people who've had a tragic home life as children, where they're totally insecure and threatened and etc. I mean, it's just the luck of the draw.
It's definitely not luck of the draw, and it is absolutely a response to either abuse or neglect. But it's not so much what happens to somebody or doesn't happen. It's who is around you as a human being before, during, and after to help us make sense of things. You know, we know human beings can endure all sorts of things as long as there are people around to say, look, we're in it together. I've got your back. Let's talk about
it. Great point. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not what happens, it's the sense we make of it. And so-called, and it is so-called codependence with this changing understanding and diagnosis, does come from either abuse or neglect. And abuse is a strong word, of course, and people bandy it around along with trauma. But, you know, somewhere where the child's needs, certainly emotional needs, aren't met, the child does not feel safe and loses faith in human beings. And, of course, worst of all, might lose faith in their caretakers, the people who were supposed to be there to look after them.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. What about sort of the dovetailing of other things? I mean, you know, for instance, if we know somebody, Ted, and Ted is a workaholic and basically, you know, spends all his time at the office because he's, you know, that's what does it for him. Is there an element of that, of the codependency in that, or is it completely separate workology?
Well, I think every addict actually has some traits that we would call codependent. Some are more extreme than others, because all of this distress and addiction comes out of a relational wound. So every addict is trying to regulate themselves. So Ted, the workaholic that you described, is trying to regulate himself by keeping very, very busy. I mean, workaholism isn't about work. It's about busyness. It's about an addiction to, it's what we call a flight opioid addiction. So you think about fight and flight and freeze, and there's a fourth F called fawn. Workaholism is a flight. If only I can get this job done, or everything will be okay. I'll be safe and secure and lovable. But of course, once the job is done, you need another one. And so Ted can't stop. Now, Ted, if Ted has a partner, if somebody's going to stick around with all of that, then there's going, you know, we would call them the codependent. So Ted has a codependence anyway, but it's developed into a workaholism. His partner may have some other addictions, but somewhere will be dependent because, you know, they're staying, you know, beyond the leave by date with somebody who's not present.
Yeah, I just think it's important that the whole purpose of today is to get an insight into this so people can understand it a bit and move on. One of my questions, and I think I'm going to withdraw it, was, you know, what's the worst example you've ever heard of in this thing? But I guess we can just...
I mean, it might be worth thinking about. I mean, the worst examples are the codependent who... So somebody who is controlling and coercive and abusive would be a codependent, what we call a fight type, managing anxiety by putting other people at dis-ease. Their partners tend to be the fawn type, managing anxiety by putting the other at ease. So the worst case of codependence that you hear are people who will cover up, bright, intelligent people who will cover up crimes, often of abuse, for example. So think about some of the abuses that, institutional abuses that are coming out left, right and centre. Think about Smythe in the Church of England, for example.
Yes.
The most prolific child abuser. Had a very seemingly very intelligent wife who somehow is unable to see fully what is happening, and certainly out of some loyalty to partner, unable to report. So, you know, this is very, very serious, do you know?
Yeah.
For any crime of abuse.
Yeah, because it's the person, the partner is blocked and can't see it.
I don't know that case intimately, so this is all sort of alleged and based on things that I read. But I was trying to, you know, in terms of news report, but just trying to give an example, and that will make sense. And you know, gosh, we know that there are people that go to prison because they've covered things up for their partners, and covered things up that have been heinous.
This is not uncommon, is it? I mean, you know, when you look at there was a murderer. There was a famous film called 10 Rillington Place, which was about Christie, who murdered a lot of local women by pretending to be a doctor. You know, and it was at a time when there was terrible, sort of during the war, after all, there was terrible bronchitis and things. And his wife was very similar. You know, she knew something was wrong, but never did a thing until he got her. So I do think that's interesting, and yeah, we get more and more insight into this, which I really like. So, I mean, obviously, you go on talking about different examples, but what I think would be really interesting now is how do people get well in this situation?
Okay. Well, I think I said earlier on, people get unwell in the course of relationships, and they can get well in the course of relationships. If co-regulation, feeling safe with others, has failed, and they end up self-regulating in dysfunctional ways, adaptive ways, putting people at ease or putting people at dis-ease to somehow feel safe and belonging, actually recovery from this means going the other way, but it means doing what never felt safe, which is to tell someone who I am and how I feel, you know, let alone what I think. And, you know, the self-help movement has developed out of that. And therapy is often a beginning place. It's a rehearsal studio and isn't it, for that sort of thing? You can tell your therapist something, and very often, I mean, the real problem is, particularly because I'm an addiction specialist, the last thing we want is for people to be dependent on their therapist. So yeah. If you share some story about yourself and who you are and how you feel with me, and that feels safe, at some point I'm going to say, Jeremy, could you tell someone else? Is there anyone else you could tell? What I would not be doing is saying tell everybody because you can't trust everyone. But no. We're trying to expand what we call a window of tolerance for, you know, being yourself and around others, which is again why, you know, so people get well in relationship, but not just any old relationship.
I get that. But I mean, if, you know, Veronica is the really serious codependent, does she know that? Does she understand that? Does she have insight into it enough to come and talk to somebody such as yourself or you know, somebody she really trusts? I mean, that's the big thing, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah, well, I think with these sort of wounds that become and the responses that become addictive, you know, you'll know from the people that you've spoken to that addiction, you know, people only change their behavior when the cost of continuing is greater than the cost of changing. You know, so actually people change when there are consequences. You know, I cannot carry on. Yeah. Veronica, who maybe is married to Ted, the workaholic, I don't know this person, she's unlikely to come to therapy for herself. She'd probably come along to see a therapist to talk about Ted.
Yes.
See, what can I do? You know, because actually, you know, Veronica, unknown to her, is also quite controlling. What can I do to get Ted to change, you know, to meet my needs? And at some point, the, you know, the wise therapist might want to say, Veronica, let's have a chat about you.
You know? No. I think that's classic. You know, I maybe talk about Ted. And I guess that's probably something you hear and now and again, definitely.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some jokes, you know, the light bulb jokes. We talk about the codependents, you know, there's two, the fawn type codependent who fawns in order, puts people at ease. The joke is, you know, how many codependents does it take to change a light bulb? Do you know this one? And the answer is, the answer is none. You go and have a good time. I'm okay here in the dark. And then with a fight type, the codependent who gets off on putting someone else by controlling them and putting them at dis-ease, you know, how many of them does it take to change a light bulb? And again, the answer is none. It's your fault we're in the dark and you should be ashamed of yourself.
That's great. I like that. I don't know the exact wording on this, but it's something like when you're going to leave me, that's fine, but can I come with you?
I like that too.
It's quite interesting.
So
basically, that's the first port of call, is to talk to somebody, and to talk to somebody after that, as it were. And then, I guess
I think there's more to it, actually, because, you know, what we have, and particularly with social media and stuff, there's a lot of information out there.
Yeah.
And one of the terms we're using now is sort of bibliotherapy, you know, bibliotherapy, you know, people, you know, reading books about, you know, there are so many self-help groups about these things. So sometimes that's usually how it begins. This is what happened with Robin Norwood's book, Women Who Love Too Much. And then, of course, she had all these letters from men saying, wait a minute, I'm exactly the same as this. You know, and there was another book, you know, that comes out of it. So, you know, people get, there's a sense of belonging and safety reading about, hearing about, gosh, I'm not the only one. This is the thing. You know, and that often then moves people towards self-help groups or therapy, or maybe just trying to talk to, you know, maybe talk to the few people that they can trust a little bit.
What do you think? Because I know there is a 12-step group called CODA, and is that, I don't know if that's the only one, you know, for this type of thing, but what's your view on that? What do you think?
I mean, the thing is about so-called 12th step, it all came out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think there are, you know, probably over 50 different self-help groups using the same principles. There's a whole range of principles that just seem to be very useful for helping people to get regulation. One of the big things about self-help groups is you move from the isolation of I to a recovery with a we.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. And people get and self-help, you know, right from the very beginning. You might set the chairs up together, do you know? And it's a sense of, gosh, you know, maybe, you know, my well-being will come from being part of rather than being, you know, compulsively self-reliant.
Yeah.
So I can't speak about CODA as a 12-step group, but you know, group therapies and groups are very good. And actually, all sorts of other groups that people belong to, whether it's your book group, you know, these things can also be regulating. Recovery happens in relationship. That's the point, not in isolation. The difference, you know, the opposite of addiction is connection. Addiction is about protection.
Yeah.
Recovery is about connection.
But the word belonging is being mentioned quite a bit. And I think that's, I suspect that's quite important. That, you know, I belong to this group, or I belong to the book group, or whatever it is, but I belong. And I would think, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with, you know, their ex-partner or whatever it is. They're doing it for themselves and they're belonging. They have a sense of belonging.
Well, being part of, because if you belong, you feel significant. You know, we're top of the food chain, you know, for a reason. For tens of thousands of years, we've survived as, you know, humankind. Not that we've always been kind, and there's lots of evidence that we're not, but we've survived in groups. So we are motivated, those of us that have survived are those that have been motivated to belong. We seek proximity to others to feel safe and secure. And, you know, and we need to feel significant. And if we feel significant, then... and belonging, we can feel safe and secure. And
yes, so I mean, if Ted or Veronica came to see you just for, you know, 10 minutes of advice, you know, where might you point them? I mean, would you point them to a group? Would you point them to a therapist? I'm just interested as to if there's a rule of thumb, right, look, you need to do, you know, a certain amount of time, certain amount of sessions with somebody, you know, or just join a group and don't really work out in the end, after 2 years, you'll be fine.
I think I probably wouldn't tell them that. but the great thing about working around addiction in general is that people who want to get well nowadays can. And that wasn't the case 50 years ago because there weren't the opportunities. If somebody comes to see me, you know, people need psychoeducation. They need to understand, look, this is a thing. This is what's going on with you. A bit like, you know, if you've got nasal pain, if you go to see a doctor and they say, well, look, this is what it is, you may not feel better. You may not feel physically better, but you'll feel, you know, you'll be a bit more regulated. Okay, I know what I've got, or I know what I haven't got, perhaps. So there's some psychoeducation. In general, we're trying to teach people to do two things. One is to co-regulate. So yes, perhaps join a group. So Ted, you're a workaholic. You know, there are some groups like Workaholics Anonymous. It seems to be very successful. You know, check it out. Not for everybody. But, you know, start telling people, you know, that you trust, you know, that this is what's going on for you. Be suspicious. This isn't about work. It's about you managing your nervous system by keeping busy and you become addicted to the cortisol and the adrenaline.
Yeah.
And you are, as I said before, you're drinking seawater to quench your thirst.
Yeah.
You're going bonkers. It's having consequences. So that's the co-regulation. We'd also be teaching people self-regulation. One of the problems with people with addiction and codependency, they're in survival. So they tend to be shallow breathers. And shallow breathing is associated with a hypervigilance. You know, there's danger around the next corner.
Right.
So one of the things, very simply, and this is free, really teaching people to breathe properly, to that. And think about it, the sigh of relief. You know, that there's a reason for that. Think about people going to church or chanting. You know, people feel good. It's the hymns that people like have the longest notes. When you say, oh God, for the whole of the bar, then actually you are moving your autonomic nervous system from the hypervigilant state, which is called sympathetic, unhelpfully, to what's called a parasympathetic state, which is rest and digest, relate and create. That's why people smoke. You know, the most addictive thing about smoking is the long out breath. Anxious people smoke. The only time they do a long out breath and calm themselves is when they're exhaling the smoke.
Right. Gosh, didn't know any of that.
And, you know, the pharmaceutical companies will tell you it's about nicotine and we'll replace it over a period of months at great cost. But actually, you know, smoking is it's a dysfunctional attempt at self-regulation by, you know, to breathe out.
That's just brilliant, actually. Really, really, really interesting. Thank you very, very much. What we're now going to do is we're now going to go and talk a little bit more about you and your life jackets. And we do this because, I mean, basically, you know, if Ted was on, you know, we would want Ted to say, Ted would tell his story, and then Ted would say how he stays together. Stayed together because he's got various life jackets. And I know that you have, I'm going to go straight in, and you said the film that does it for you, or did it for you, was The Man Who Fell to Earth. Briefly, why?
Well, Nicholas Rogue's film, you know, starring David Bowie. And, you know, David, I'm knocking on a bit, and I was a young teenager when David Bowie appeared on Top of the Pops, dressed with such, in a way that we'd never seen before, that blurred sexuality in some star man, appeared on screen to almost, you know, fellate Mick Ronson's Les Paul guitar. And I just thought, God, this is so exciting as we break away from, you know, what is it about the way that we dress, you know, and why? And I could go off at a tangent, but, you know, this whole idea that actually dress, and also dress is so defining of gender. Men wear ties as if... you know, but it's like, I've got a penis, and women will have a low plunging, you know, a V, you know, what is that saying? I've got a vagina, do you know? And actually suddenly said, let's just re-examine everything. He was a very exciting guy, and he would say he was an actor, and Nicholas Rogue merged the character in The Man Who Fell to Earth, Thomas Jerome, didn't he, with Bowie's character, That was very exciting. And it's a film about sort of cultural seduction and moral corrosion. You know, this good guy comes to Earth and actually finds television and alcohol and sex and a gun. I found it very absorbing. I've seen it a few times. I think if I saw it recently, it'd probably feel a bit sort of slow and laboured because it doesn't have any CGI or, you know, anything fast moving or handheld. But
of course, the interesting thing, briefly, is that... you know, it's 10 years now since Bowie died. And yet the interest in him is just growing and growing, you know. And I think a lot of people are actually just recognizing how great he really was and, you know, how original, brave, and very charming as well. You know, I saw a film, there's a film on YouTube of one of his very last concerts, you know, in New York. And he's just so funny and nice, and I was upsetting himself. But what a guy, you know, what a guy, what an artist. The West Wing. I saw West Wing and I thought it was pretty good, but I didn't watch it all the time. So, but you really love it.
You know, it's one of the few things that I can watch again and again. It came out in the 90s. I think Aaron Sorkin is a fantastic writer. And how many script writers can you name anyway? So it's quite good. You know, I think he's one of the people that you can name. It's a great political drama in the 90s where cynicism was really sort of beginning. It's now massive, isn't it? And here we had people bringing in political issues that were quite complex, which would get alongside characters that we could identify with. It was aspirational, it was principled, you know, gave us hope. And I found it very engaging, and I think Sorkin's a great writer. I've liked other things that he's done.
Did I get this wrong or right, that there was a character in The West Wing who had bipolar?
Not that I recall. Certainly had, as was really the norm in the 90s. There was always a character who was an addict who found Chief of Staff was, was a recovering alcoholic, I think. Certainly trauma was addressed. All sorts of interesting issues were. I don't remember the bipolar.
Yeah, maybe I'm mixing myself up. I'll come back to you about that. Music. Now, you've written Led Zeppelin and David Bowie. Well, we've talked a bit about Bowie, but let's talk about Led Zeppelin. Which album did you first buy?
Well, actually, the first album I ever owned was Led Zeppelin 2, as a maybe 12 or 13 year old, and which my parents regarded as just a terrible noise. And I think when I bought it, I wasn't quite sure. I thought they might be right. And it took some listening to realize that actually here was the most remarkable quartet of musicians and virtuosos influenced by folk and rock and pop who could move a song from something quite delicate to something quite heavy. I think the lyric was young, the voice was the most powerful.
Well, I remember buying the first album and my God, you know, it was put up on the wall I just thought it was the greatest. And I have to say, and I don't know what your view on this, I used to work in that world and I managed to see virtually everybody. I never saw them play. Yeah. Did you?
No, I was too young, I'm afraid, Jeremy. Sorry to tell you then.
Okay.
I was too young.
Briefly, what period, was there, if you had to sort of say David Bowie song or David Bowie album, what would it be?
Well, you see, for somebody who was an actor and produced so many different characters and was so keen to change things, that is a very difficult question.
Yeah, I know.
I love The Man Who Sold the World as an album and a song. I like the transition into through Hunky Dory into Aladdin Sane. I like Heroes and the collaboration with Brian Eno. This is what's so exciting. This is somebody who is prepared to stop doing something at its peak, which is really quite uncommon psychologically. Most people, like sportsmen, always want to just stay on a little bit longer, or chief executives. Dump something and everybody else and go somewhere else.
No, I mean, he had a lot of chutzpah, courage, and I think sometimes he was off his head, a lot off his head. But, you know, as you say, to basically go, this is nearly at its peak, I'm stopping it. Next, you know, that's quite something. And I think he was quite something. Yes, we
do. And off his head is an interesting thing, because I don't know if that, clearly by the time The Man Who Sold the World, and it just preceded Bowie moving to Berlin, didn't it? You know, a bit that he talked about, and in a flat share with Iggy Pop. I mean, that's a flat share and a half, isn't it? Those two it's very hard to perform and be an artist without some of these mood altering chemicals. But I had a chat to, is it Woody Woodmansey, the drummer of the Spiders at Mars, and asking about the recording album Manifold to Earth, a bit like, sort of, you know, what was everyone taking in the studio? What were and actually it was like, I think he said cup of tea.
Well,
it's not all drug inspired.
Okay, so let's move on. We're going to gardening, and what we've got down here is your favourite special subject in gardening is growing vegetables. Well, are you pleading guilty?
Yeah, well, slightly. As a historic crime, I think. I don't get a lot of time for growing vegetables. I had my father died when I was about 15, and I didn't see much of him anyway, actually. Mm. But he liked gardening and sort of probably where he hid away with his tomato, you know, in his greenhouse with too many tomatoes. So, you know, I quite like that. And of course we all do. The idea of nurturing something is deeply symbolic, isn't it? Looking after and watching it grow. I don't get a lot of time. And actually my wife is a fantastic gardener. She's a real plants person.
Yeah.
And so I get the Oscar for best supporting actor.
Yes. The wheelbarrow mover. That's great. I had exactly the same experience. I mean, my father lived in the garden. My wife is a brilliant gardener.
Yeah.
But I actually get great sort of solace and comfort just from weeding or just being out there and doing this, moving that, cutting that, doing that bit.
It's primal, isn't it? It's what, you know, it's that connection, and ecotherapy is a big thing now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great thing to do. And my ultimate thing is mowing the lawn. I love mowing the lawn. Anyway, we're not here to support me. Exercise hobbies are the gym. Now, Paul, what have you got to say? Are you a fanatic in the gym? Are you a circuit person or you're what?
Well, I'm a guy in his mid-60s that knows that most people die following a fall in some way. And so I am quite keen to strengthen my core and my legs. And I'm 6 foot, stand upright. I like the gym, mostly because actually I put my AirPods in, I listen to an audio book, I do a good bit of breathing, and I do a bit of sort of some weights and stuff like that. But don't get me wrong, this is just a little bit of just staying alive.
But how often do you do it?
Probably a couple of times a week, just to go along and say, just a nice experience. Depending what time I go, if I go on a Sunday morning, I bring the average age down. If I go in the evening, I'm one of the oldies.
Okay, that's good, but it makes you feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a form of self-regulation. I'm treating myself as valuable. Back to codependency, and the loss of self, it's about survival now. It's about urgency rather than taking the long view. Recovery is about being able to take the long view, let's look after myself now because I don't want to have a fall later,
Right. Okay. Well, I think
there's so much more we could talk about.
There is so much more we can talk about, and we will do that another time. But I want to thank you, really thank you very much for coming on and doing this. It's been really interesting. Paul, thank you. I really appreciate it. Really great.
Yeah, nice to meet you and to see you, Jeremy. Best wishes.
All right, until the next time.
Until the next time.